Hi, today I'm going to talk to you about the impact of cover cropping in semi-arid environments on soil, fungal, and biological properties. And first, what I want to kind of do is get us thinking about the connection between the above ground and below ground and how the soil functions as sort of the heart or the centerpiece of the system. And the organisms that I've spent most of my career working on are bacterial mycorrhizal fungi, which have a direct link between the above ground via the plant host that they're growing with. And there's a lot that can be done when you focus on that soil environment and how to be able to improve the efficiency in that soil environment to get greater production. Let me kind of show this graph to you quick with the soil food web. I'm not going to go into all of the different organisms that are existing in the soil environment and how they impact each other individually in any detail, but what I wanted to kind of get, the reason I wanted to show this is to look at this first trophic level. And energy and carbon molecules, or carbon that's used as the building blocks for every molecule and every organism in this environment, it comes from the plant. And so it comes first from the photosynthetic activity of that plant. So having to have a living plant in this system is very important. And cover crops can play a strong role in this, in the fact that they extend the period of time that you have a living plant growth. And what we're trying to do with this is we're trying to create a system in which water and nutrient use efficiency are maximized. And I can try and break this down between physical, chemical, and biological types of impacts. But in reality, all of these processes are sort of interrelated. There's always a chemical or biological key involved in some physical processes and vice versa. There's a lot of interaction and interrelationship in the system as we're trying to improve water and nutrients. To begin with, in looking at the physical impact and how this plays a role, I'm going to start with looking at soil aggregation. And soil aggregates are pellets in the soil that are conglomerations formed by hyperlinked roots, nets where organic matter and clay minerals and sand particles and bacteria and various cations, things like that, are conglomerated into sort of a single type of pellet. And those pellets are really important to issues like water infiltration and water holding capacity because they create that soil structure in that environment where you have greater porosity. And so if you improve porosity, you can see that there's an improvement not just in the infiltration rate at the first inch, but in the infiltration rate of subsequent inches. That you're able to get water into the soil environment much more quickly. And because the water is in columns that go around the soil aggregates instead of completely vertical columns, those bends and those curves mean that the water is not going to be evaporated off of the surface very quickly. It takes a lot more energy to basically suck that out of the soil when it's all curved and bent around these aggregates. And you're not going to lose a lot of water to gravitational flow as well. It's going to hold more water in that rooting environment and in that growing environment. The other thing that having aggregates does is aggregates can help to improve the surface area to volume ratio. And in some cases, this happens just naturally by the fungal hyphae. The fungal hyphae are very thin. They don't have a lot of width to them, but they can extend into hundreds of meters per gram of soil. So they can extend out into a very large amount of soil and are able to have greater contact with nutrients and water in that soil environment. And the aggregates are also going to do that where they're going to have that surface on the aggregates going to have more exposure to that soil environment, as well as inside the aggregate, the bacteria and other organisms, the fungal hyphae that are trapped inside that aggregate, are not going to be exposed to some of the larger organisms, so that means that more organic matter can be held in those aggregates for a longer period of time, and that affects nutrient flow. So either this is really important, like I said, to improve inflow structures and improve porosity, again, water to thin flow more quickly, more water to tell. But it's also important for air movement, for oxygen from the surface to get into the soil and create an aerobic environment for the various organisms as well as the roots that are growing in that soil. And on top of that, for CO2 to escape from that soil environment and roots and organisms not suffocate because of high CO2 concentrations. Aggregates, again, when they're in that conglomeration form, they're more resistant to erosion. It takes a lot more energy in a wind or rain, and that move particles of a larger size than it does to move particles of a smaller size. And you get improvements then inside the aggregate that I alluded to with it being a protective habitat, where you can improve nutrient cycling, which means that the organisms that are inside that aggregate are going to be breaking down the organic matter more slowly, just as a consequence of their size, because you're keeping larger organisms restricted from that aggregate environment. In addition, within that aggregate environment, you can have various zones that'll be aerobic and some zones that'll be anaerobic, and you can have different organisms functioning at different rates in those different zones. The chemical aspect of this efficiency that I want to kind of focus a little bit on is this idea of plant available and unavailable nutrients, and how nutrients in some cases become unavailable, and what organisms might be able to do to make those nutrients available. So you have various nutrients combined to solid soil colors, you can have them bind to inorganic minerals, and you can have those nutrients that are now locked up. They're not things that the plant is able to take up, but bacteria and fungi can produce various enzymes that are going to break those nutrients off of these binding sites and be able to release them in plant available form. And that allows them to be released over time. So just like in an aggregate where nutrients are decomposed at a slower rate, it sort of acts like a continuous fertilizer delivery to the plant rather than the available nutrients being available at one particular time and not available again throughout the growing season. The other thing with working with the organisms is that it greatly improves the efficiency of those nutrients to be able to get to the plant itself. Many of these organisms are growing in a variety of the environment that's going right around the root. And when they're doing that process near the roots and near the root hairs, so the plants can take those nutrients up very quickly. Without those organisms and without this rise to their activity, plants are pretty much reliant upon mass flow for the nutrients to be able to get to the roots, which means that in some cases, the roots have to exude more water to try and get more nutrients to diffuse towards those roots. And you're going to reduce some of the efficiency of those nutrients being able to make it through that path to get to the roots. It's a very inefficient system to rely solely on diffusion, whereas relying on the enzymatic and breakdown activity of the organisms that are right around the roots. And that's the reason why the plants give off exudates that attract these organisms, is that it's a much more efficient mechanism being able to get those nutrients. The other thing is when that's happening in the rhizosphere and happening via the organisms that are in the soil, you can get less nutrient runoff, you get less loss to surface runoff as well as to groundwater contamination. So the available nutrients may be held for a period of time in that rooting environment and then released by the activity of this. Now from a biological standpoint, like I said, there's a lot of interactive factors involved in each of these different processes, the physical, the chemical, and the biological. And soil aggregation is one that seems to cross all of those barriers. Aggregate formation and aggregate stabilization is oftentimes driven by biology, whether it's the roots and fungal hyphae and the exudates coming from the roots and coming from bacteria, the various polysaccharides that are helping to form and glue an aggregate together, or you're looking at molecules like bromelain, which is produced by the arrestinal mycorrhizal fungi, or other molecules that can add to that waxy coating on that surface and help to make it stable. In addition, like I said, you have various enzymes that are formed by different organisms in the soil. Some of them that can release various carbon compounds, some of them can release phosphorus, and then you have some of them that are involved in nitrogen fixation. So you have a lot of activity that can happen in that biological environment, in the environment right around the root. And some of this that they refer to as sort of plant growth promoting livestock organisms. So you have these different organisms that are living in that environment and are able to provide nutrients to the plant over time, and are also able to help to provide some protection to some pathogens to the plant as well. In addition, you can have this idea of interplant nutrient transfer, which means that nitrogen that may be fixed inside the roots of a legume plant may be taken up and delivered via fungal hyphae to another nearby plant. And this is one of the really interesting things that we're finding in these cover crop systems. You have mycorrhizal fungi that can colonize fungus can colonize multiple plants, and one plant can be colonized by multiple types of mycorrhizal fungi, which means, one, there's a lot of resiliency and redundancy and function when you have all of those different types of mycorrhizal fungi that may have different rates of being able to acquire phosphorus or micronutrients or water that are benefiting the plant, as well as you have that connection between plants. So in some cases, that mycorrhizal relationship with the host plant stimulates greater phosphorus uptake. Oftentimes this happens in various grass plants, whereas in a legume plant, there's a phosphorus demand to provide the energy involved in being able to fix nitrogen. You need to have phosphorus input into that process. And so if you have nutrients that are being taken up and accessed by the fungal hyphae associated with the grass plant, that same hyphae can colonize a legume plant and deliver some of that phosphorus to the legume plant, which then gives it to the bacteria in the nodules where nitrogen is fixed. And some of that nitrogen can then follow through up into that legume plant, get into the fungal hyphae, and then get into the grass plant. And there's a lot of evidence that's been studied for a number of years, but a lot of it's been done under more controlled conditions and not with some of the mixtures that we're finding in these cover crop systems, as well as what we might find in prairie systems. So there's a lot of interest in being able to figure out how these systems might work and what things can enhance this happening at a greater rate. And I mentioned the Arbexia mycorrhizal fungi, that's what I've spent most of my career on. I know my co-author works a lot more with enzymes produced by mother organisms. But what I'm going to kind of focus a little bit more on is this idea with what happens with the Arbexia mycorrhizal fungi, because our initial thought when we look at this is that they're very good at getting nutrients and delivering them to the plant. But in the process of doing this, they've greatly improved the efficiency of this process. Because the hyphal strands are so thin, but they're very, very long, they can have contact with much more of the soil environment. And then that surface area to volume ratio that we talked about in physical parameters, they repeat that inside the plant roots. As you can see in this picture, you have arbuscules and hyphal strands that are stained inside the plant roots, and at those arbuscules is where the nutrients and water are delivered to the plant next to the cell membrane. They penetrate the cell wall and are inside up next to the cell membrane. So it's very efficient at being able to drop those things off, and then they're traded for carbon from the plant, as the plant makes the photosynthesis. And then that carbon can go out into the environment, and it can be able to, in some cases, the fungal hyphae up some other organisms that are colonizing that hyphae. And the carbon that was obtained from the plant can be used to feed those other organisms as well as extending the pipeline that looks out into the soil, and again, connecting multiple plants with multiple different types of species. There's a lot of advantages to having these mycorrhizal fungi. What I want to talk to you about quickly is one of the experiments that was done in Mandan, North Dakota, at one of our research station plots, where we set up an experiment to kind of test this idea of cover crops when we had single species cover crops that we put in, and also different types of mixtures. We had a mixture that had all of the different individual species that we were testing, and then we had mixtures that had one or more species that were missing. And so we were trying to see what species may have play a more vital role in this type of system. And so what we set up a plot where we had four replicates for each of these systems, and we had 19 different cover crop combinations, as you saw on the table previously. And so in the first year, we had spring wheat, and then we followed that with peas, and after the peas came on, we put one of 19 different cover crop combinations on the field, and then we followed that with one of four response crops. And so we had a three-year rotation in the system, and then we were also able to test what the impact of having these different cover crops may have, again, on sort of response crop or subsequent crop. This experiment was replicated in time. It was staggered 1 year off. So in our first field, we had it in three different fields. In our first field, it was set up in 2008, and that went, so we did, the cover crop seasons went from 2008 to 2009, and the spring was from 2007. And so then the next one was started a year later. So that the cover crops and response crops were in 2009 and 2010, and then in the final field it was 2010 and 2011. A little bit of preliminary data from this, but and so I have some other colleagues that are presenting some other data with some other colleagues in some different talks here, primarily Mark Rubick and Dave Archer are presenting some of the data along with some other colleagues. So we're kind of able to look at some of the biomass information, production information, and baseline soil information. What I was most interested in was looking at glomerular production and soil aggregation. So I collected the soil samples immediately following a hard frost when in the year that they had the cover crops in, and then immediately following a hard frost in the year that we had the response crops. And so I took soil samples. First thing I did was I dry sieved the soil samples to separate out different dry aggregate sizes, and then I measured the amount of soil that was in each of the sizes so we could get sort of a distribution of the soil in each of the aggregate sizes. And then I extracted glomalin from subsamples from each of the sizes. And we measured glomalin utilizing a colorimetric protein assay to get an idea of concentration. And then with the aggregates, we followed that by measuring the water stable aggregation levels, and then that data was combined into a whole soil stability index. So we're able to kind of get an idea of how stabilized the soils are, and if there was a difference that happened by having the cover crops in the system, as well as correlating this data with glomalin production and seeing if there were some differences in how that may impact the. So again, this is all sort of preliminary data, and there's a lot more analysis that needs to get teased out of this, and this is actually only for two of the fields that was in place in 2000 to 2009, or it had a cover crop in 08 and a response crop in 09, and then the fields that had crops in place from 2008 to 2010 with the cover crops in place in 2009 and the response crop in 2010. The final site, we're still looking at processing the samples. Obviously, there's a lot of samples involved here. But what you can see in the first field, what we had was we had a consistent decline in water stabilization in the second year. So I basically took the second year values and extracted the first year values from the data. And so what I wanted to see is if there was a positive or a negative change. And then the negative change in the first field that we looked at, field called field G. And then the second field that we looked at, field H, there was more of a positive increase in the whole soil stability index in the second year. But there were still some plants and some cover crop mixtures in which there was a decline in that index set. And then here are kind of the glomalin values. And what's interesting about comparing these two is the pattern seems to be opposite. So the whole soil stability index was pretty much all negative in field G for the index. But the glomalin values is pretty much all positive. And again, the glomalin was extracted from each of the aggregate size classes. So this is the 9.5-2 millimeter aggregate and the 2-1 millimeter aggregate. And then in field H, pretty much all of the levels of glomalin measured as Bradford reactive soil protein were negative. Whereas when you looked at the index, all of those values were positive, almost all of those values were positive. So there's some interesting things that we can look at from this data and try and get an understanding of maybe how various types of carbon inputs may be impacting that production of glomalin as well as the production of soil aggregation. In addition to this study, we've got a number of studies that are just beginning, as well as some studies that we're working on for a little bit longer. One of the studies we're looking at is looking at cover crop mixtures and the expression to see if the timing of placing the cover crop mixtures and at different concentration levels, how that would help with suppressing weeds and play a role in reducing the amount of pesticides that we're having to use. We've also got some integrated crop livestock systems that are utilizing cover crops to help to extend the grazing season. And also to provide some different nutrient value to the livestock. And then one of the other experiments that I'm really excited about is one where we're setting up at a rainout shelter where we're going to be able to control precipitation. And then I'm inserting in there some mini chambers where we can collect fungal hyphae and glomalin outside of any roots. So there's mesh barriers inside these chambers that are then restrict larger or microscopic organisms as well as the roots being able to penetrate further inside and just be able to get great collections of mycorrhizal fungi. In addition, we're going to be looking at some different organic matter fractions, some soluble carbon and nitrogen fractions, as well as some tannins that are in the soil. So what I find really interesting about cover crops is they have the potential to fill in gaps in the system, which means basically if you've got an issue, rather than having to add a lot of diversity and make a lot of changes in your equipment and your production practices for your cash crops, you can actually use the cover crop to fill in those gaps. So if you've got some pest problems, you're able to utilize a crop that may help to control those pest populations to reduce some of the carryover, those types of things. Also, crops that are going to provide different types of carbon and nitrogen, organic matter and debris, which is going to allow for some different microorganisms to be able to grow and improve the diversity of the system. And when you've got different plants, not only do you have different carbon and nitrogen ratios, but you also have different leaf sizes, which can help to reduce weed populations because they're going to help provide shading over a much greater surface. And then at the same time, they can provide organic matter that is of different carbon and nitrogen concentrations, which are going to break down differently and provide more protection over time. So So all of this, what we're trying to do is improve the nitrogen or the water and nutrient use efficiencies of our system. We're trying to be able to increase the amount of carbon sequestration that we have by forming soil aggregates, as well as decrease the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from these soils, and decrease greenhouse gas emissions from creating plant available nutrients, transporting them, and applying them to fields, but instead relying on organisms and systems. And as we look at trying to increase the sustainable intensification of our systems, get more out of our systems than we put into them, and trying to get multiple enterprises out of our systems and multiple factors out of our systems, that's going to improve the quality of the systems, and as our population expands, we're going to need to be addressing this in such a way that I feel the new green revolution is actually going to be a revolution that is focused on soil environment, or is a brown revolution. So with that, if you have any questions, I apologize for not being able to be there in person, but please feel free to contact me via email or phone, and I'll try and answer those questions or refer you to someone who probably can answer them better than I can. Please feel free to contact me if you have any ideas or concerns or something that you would like to be able to study in the system. So, thank you.